This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. James Bennett has just completed three eventful years covering the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. He's chronicled suicide bombings, the Israeli incursions into the West Bank, and most recently the construction of a controversial security barrier in the West Bank and plans to withdraw from Israeli settlements in Gaza. His reporting is focused not just on policymakers and military leaders, but on grieving relatives and survivors of violence, as well as ordinary Israelis and Palestinians struggling to live their lives and understand the conflict that divides them. Bennett's most recent piece is the cover story of this week's Times magazine on Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Sharon's story, Bennett writes, has become Israel's story. I spoke to James Bennett this morning. Sharon nearly died in a battle in the 1948 war, in a place that's visible from the main highway between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, the plains of Latrun. You spoke to him about that in your most recent interview with him. What is his perspective on that period, on that event?
This is one of the most searing battles of that war, because there were a large number of new immigrants who fought. Many Israelis feel they were totally unprepared, because they went into the battle with bad intelligence, because they lost day after day trying to take this one extremely strategic hill, which has for centuries, really thousands of years, has been used as a redoubt to guard the main route to Jerusalem from the coast and from Egypt. Sharon was a platoon leader in 1948, and he was leading his men towards the hill, believing it was very lightly defended. They were coming in at dawn, in a thick fog. They'd supposed to have struck hours before that, but for various reasons of poor logistics, they were delayed. They're approaching the hill. They're in these barley fields. All of a sudden, the sun comes up, the fog lifts, and the men were totally exposed. The Arab Legion, it turned out, was guarding the hill at the time, very heavily armed. They pinned them down. Sharon and his men took refuge in the small gully and were basically being picked apart. Only a handful out of 35 men escaped uninjured from this. Sharon himself was shot in the stomach and thigh and lay for hours bleeding in this gully. His radio was destroyed and he didn't hear the order to withdraw. He says that he only realized that the Israeli forces had withdrawn when he looked over his shoulder and saw that there were now Arab fighters behind him. So he was then confronted with trying to get out of there, badly wounded with only a handful of his men. The story he told me was about dragging himself to the bottom of this gully where there was a small amount of water, kind of green slime, standing water there that had mixed with the blood of the wounded who had been dragged back to that area. He said he hesitated for a minute and then stuck his face into this mix of blood and scum and muddy water and drank deeply, and it was only that, he said, that gave him the strength to get out of there.
You wrote that Sharon, when he was a paratrooper, developed a strategy for responding to ambushes, which was that you attack, that you have to immediately regain and retain the initiative. I'm wondering if you see that approach in his response to the latest Palestinian uprising.
This has characterized his approach to everything, I think, throughout his career. He believes that if you surrender the initiative, if you give up the initiative, you're on your way to losing. That's what happened at the beginning of the 1973 war, the Yom Kippur War, when he also learned a searing lesson. And I think it does characterize his approach to this conflict throughout. While the Palestinian leadership has fallen into disarray, into chaos, as the Bush administration has occasionally tried to put forward its own peace initiative, Sharon has really been the one figure who's been in constant motion, I think, who had some idea of what he wanted and a strategy for achieving that. And that's very much what we're seeing now, as Ariel Sharon is really the only force who's attempting to change the situation there. The Palestinian leadership has largely fallen apart. The Bush administration has put its own peace initiative, the roadmap, on the shelf. And Ariel Sharon is basically putting everybody else on his back and carrying them where he wants them to go.
Before we talk about his current initiatives in Israel, I have to ask you your reflections on one of the times in the past when he seized the initiative, and that was the invasion of Lebanon, which began, I guess, as an attempt to clear out Palestinian sanctuaries, which were used to attack northern Israel. but which, you know, became a bit of a disaster militarily and diplomatically for Israel. How does he regard that episode? I mean, was in his career?
Well, let me say before addressing that question, the Lebanon invasion was sold to the public by Ariel Sharon as a very limited effort to clear away the PLO from the northern border with Lebanon. But in fact, he had much grander strategic aims in mind. He wanted to install a new Lebanese government that would be friendly to Israel and, in fact, establish relations with Israel. He hoped that by going into Lebanon, he would reshuffle the strategic balance and bring forth a new tractable Palestinian leadership in the West Bank that Israel could then deal with. He had these very grand aims, as he often does, and it completely blew up in his face with first the assassination of his chosen Lebanese leader and then the massacre of Palestinians in two refugee camps that an Israeli commission of inquiry later held him indirectly responsible for. Sharon tells people privately that one thing he learned from that experience is that you cannot go to war into some sort of a controversial action like that if you don't have the Israeli public fully behind you and if you don't have some kind of unity government, which is to say a broad-based coalition not made up only of right-wing parties but also left-wing parties. I think you're beginning to see that at work here. He's trying to assemble a new governing coalition, will over time, I think, that will include more moderate parties because he wants to have that kind of broad-based political support.
The interesting thing about that lesson, I suppose, is that he doesn't conclude that there were limits to what Israeli power could accomplish in a complex Arab environment. It was more that he didn't have the support that he needed to sustain the effort and get where he needed to go.
Exactly. He writes in a very interesting way in his autobiography about this experience. Most of his anger seems to be directed at fellow Israelis who he feels turned on him unfairly. He's very angry at what he saw as the disunity in Israeli society, that was the real problem here, this lack of unity in the face of a real external threat. And I think that's where he draws his political lessons about forming a new unity government, et cetera, et cetera. But you're right. He does not say, boy, the whole idea might have been wrong. I might have been mistaken about what I was trying to do. He's a guy who really believes in grand strategy, complex plans, as long as he's the one who came up with them.
One of the things that happened in that 1982 invasion was that he appeared to have his arch nemesis, the Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat, cornered. And in the end, Arafat got away. Is he pursuing a lifelong goal here? I mean, when he made the move against Arafat in Ramallah?
He certainly has always regarded Arafat as an enemy of the Israeli state. He did try numerous times in Lebanon to kill Arafat. I mean, there were bombing around Arafat, and they simply missed him. And Arafat was finally able to leave with many of his comrades in a deal that was brokered by the United States. Israel saw that as something of a humiliation of Arafat. Arafat, of course, did it with great pageantry and tried to make withdrawal look like a victory. But the fact is that ultimately Sharon drove Arafat out of Lebanon only to find Arafat in his own backyard in Ramallah as a consequence of the Oslo peace process. Sharon's own advisors are divided about whether Ariel Sharon ever thought he might able to make a peace deal with Arafat. Some of them say he came into office believing that he might be able to make such a deal, and he actually sent his son Omri as an emissary to Arafat a couple of times. But Sharon says no, that he never saw Arafat as a potential partner. Now he's obviously successfully almost completely isolated him in Arafat's ruined compound in Ramallah and has simply kept him parked there, saying that there is no Palestinian peace partner because Arafat is still the leader of the Palestinian people and Israel can't hope to make a deal with him.
Ariel Sharon, who was the champion of the settler movement, who had a lot to do with actually designing, I guess, the settlements in Gaza, in a remarkable reversal of approach, now talks about a voluntary withdrawal from Gaza and an enforced isolation from the Palestinians. What's he up to?
Well, I think you can't overstate the importance of what he's already done in simply declaring that it is not in Israel's interest to remain in Gaza. This is a real earthquake in Israeli politics, I think, the father of the settlement movement, has essentially said that some settlements are not only not in Israel's security interest, but actually a threat to Israeli security interests. So even if he fails in this plan, if his support collapses and he vanishes as prime minister, I think he's already done a lot of damage to a cornerstone of the settlement movement. And certainly the settlers feel that way, which explains their intense anger at him now. And the Israeli Shin Bet intelligence service is extremely concerned now about threats against the life of Sharon from the right wing. I mean, it's a real kind of through-the-looking-glass moment if you step back and think about what this means in Israeli politics.
Back in 1948, when the Israeli-Palestinian conflict broke out in what Israelis, of course, refer to as the War of Independence, the posture of the Israeli government was, you don't give up an inch of land. You hold on to everything you have, and you fight for all that you can hold. Why is Gaza something that Sharon believes Israelis should now give up? Do the demographics of Gaza as opposed to other parts of the occupied territory distinguish it here?
Yes, because of the large number of Palestinians living in Gaza, 1.3 million, Gaza presents an opportunity for Israel to essentially to postpone what Israelis regard as the so-called demographic threat. That is that within a few years, and how many depends on what demographer you consult, there will be more Arabs than Jews living between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean. That is, more Arabs than Jews living in Israel, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip. The problem there, in the minds of many Israelis, is that Israel will then be faced with a choice of possibly giving up its demography or giving up its Jewish identity, that the Arabs will succeed in doing by demography what they haven't been able to do by force of arms. In order for that to happen, the Palestinians would have to overcome a huge psychological obstacle of their own and say, we give up, we want to be part of the Israeli state, make us Israeli citizens. And then what Israeli Jews fear is that the Arabs would then vote in an Arab-led government in the state of Israel. Again, that's a long way off, and it's more of a theoretical exercise right now than anything else, but it's on the minds of a lot of Israelis. And Sharon has begun to address it recently as one of the reasons for a Gaza withdrawal.
He's also endorsed the idea of a security barrier, which would, in effect, isolate Palestinians on the West Bank. Now, this was something which actually, I guess, the Israeli left had talked about for years, right?
Yes, like the Gaza withdrawal, this is an idea that really originated on the left. And Sharon initially was opposed to the idea of building this barrier. It became politically irresistible, though, because it was such a popular notion. And I think it's an example of again, classic Sharon political maneuvering, in that he was willing to shift tactics very quickly and incorporate them into a larger strategic plan. Having opposed this barrier for a long time, he embraced it and then tried to build it where he thought it would go, in a way that would include a large portion of the West Bank on, if you will, the Israeli side of the barrier. Now, the settlers were opposed to this barrier from the beginning because they saw it as ultimately becoming some sort of political boundary, and that the settlements on the wrong side would eventually have to be dismantled and evacuated. The Israeli government continues to insist that this barrier is being built only for security reasons, not for political ones, but privately they acknowledge that it does have political consequences, not only for the Palestinians, but for the settlers.
Does the withdrawal from Gaza, combined with the incursions into the West Bank and the embracing a security barrier, do they all fit into a vision for Israel's future that he sees?
Yes. He's trying to draw what he sees as the most secure boundaries for Israel, hold on to those pieces of the West Bank that he regards as most important for Israeli security, get out of Gaza, which is becoming this kind of demographic threat and this trap for the state of Israel. The barrier forms the line in the West Bank that he would ultimately, I think, retreat to if necessary. But the key aspect to all of this is that he's doing it unilaterally and without negotiating with the Palestinians. These are not concessions he's making to the Palestinians. These are concessions in a sense that he's making to what he sees as reality, that these are the lines Israel should move to. But he doesn't want to talk about dividing Jerusalem. He doesn't want to talk with the Palestinians about where these lines should go. And so far, he's successfully gotten the world to sign off on this approach.
You know, Americans often say that it It was no accident that Nixon could open the door to China, because he had been such a staunch anti-communist all his life. And I'm wondering if people in Israel who have been committed opponents of Ariel Sharon throughout his career, for taking a hard-line, hawkish view towards the Palestinians, do they now look at his reversal, of course, and his voluntary cessation of occupied territory as the kind of flexible and innovative thinking that a great leader needs? I mean, has he redeemed himself in the ideas of his, in the eyes of his critics at all?
I wouldn't say put it as strongly as achieving redemption yet. But yes, it's really interesting to talk to members of the Israeli left these days, to doves who find themselves suddenly agreeing with Ariel Sharon, at least about a Gaza withdrawal. There's this a kind of baffled self-questioning response to this, that they can't quite believe that they actually are finding themselves supportive of Ariel Sharon, a guy that many of them had accused of essentially of being a murderer for what happened in Lebanon. Some of them still think he's not serious, that he doesn't mean it, that it's all some sort of political feint. This is obviously happening at a moment of incredible disarray on Israel's left, partly because Sharon has been so successful at seizing the political center there and taking some ideas from the left, that the left has not been able to propose any kind of alternative.
In your recent piece in the New York Times Sunday Magazine, you described the army as Israel's most politically and socially important institution. Why?
Almost every Israeli passes through the army. They have to do military service. They're drafted out of high school. And that's always been the case. They have to do reserves duty that carries many of them through their mid-40s. It's the intensity of the military experience in Israel is something that I think marks Israelis for their whole lives. Particularly now, you're having a generation that's growing up in this really difficult environment, fighting in the occupied territories, manning checkpoints, demolishing Palestinian homes, the homes of the families of wanted men, for example. And I think that's having a real effect on the society. The army has always supplied prime ministers. It's supplied many of the top politicians in the state of Israel, have not just served in the army but have become generals. It's a kind of political shorthand for Israelis, left-wing Israelis, that they're tired of being led by generals, that they need somebody whose experience isn't totally formed by the army. But I think in these sorts of troubled times, they turn to people like Ariel Sharon, partly because of that military experience.
What was the effect of the collapse of the Oslo peace process on the army, and why is that important for Israel's culture and society?
Well, the army bought into Oslo. The top generals in the army accepted the essential logic of Oslo, which is that peace would bring security, as it's formulated by Israelis. The notion was that if you signed an agreement with the Palestinians, gave them what's called a political horizon, the elements of sovereignty, the beginnings of some sort of proto-state, which was the Palestinian Authority, and begin to remove the Israeli presence from the occupied territories, begin to bring soldiers out so that Palestinians didn't experience them as this oppressive force all the time. If you took those steps, Palestinians would be able to, would have the Palestinian leadership, a pragmatic Palestinian leadership, would then have the popularity in the street to crack down on groups like Hamas and Islamic Jihad. The militants would lose political support to begin with. Their actions would become unpopular because they would be seen as jeopardizing a peace that Palestinians had come to value. And as a result, the Palestinian Authority would be able to act against these groups. The Israeli army says that the Palestinian leadership was never serious about reigning in these militant groups, that Arafat liked to keep them around so that he could kind of turn up the gas on the stove a little bit, turn up the heat on Israel when things weren't going so well, and extract new concessions from Israel. As a result, the army has reached much the same conclusion that Ariel Sharon has long held, and the shorthand for this in Israel is that it's not that peace will bring security, but that security will bring peace. That is, you must have a complete cessation of violence, tranquility, before you can begin talking about these big issues that divide the two people, the issues of territory, Jerusalem, the right of return, that those matters need to be put on the shelf, and you must secure not just Israelis, but Palestinians, take violence out of the picture, and then you can begin to advance toward peace.
You know, the Israeli army, I think, you know, for a lot of years was, well, in its early years, was populated by people who'd come from the kibbutz movement, which was sort of a, you know, this idealistic view. I mean, who's in the Israeli army now? Is it different?
It is changing. Again, this is, I think, a long-term social change, but one that's become evident in recent years. The kibbutzim are supplying less of a proportion of the top leadership of the army, and it's the national religious movement, I think, that's now supplying more of those soldiers. The army is becoming, like the rest of society, is becoming more religious, and some of these guys come out of a background that really does regard the West Bank and Gaza as Israel's biblical birthright.
Well, in July, you wrote a couple of deep pieces about life in two Palestinian settings, one in Gaza and the other in the city of Jenin. Let's talk about Jenin for a bit. What has happened to the Palestinian Authority and to life in Jenin as a result of, well, over the years in which we've had this uprising against the Israeli occupation combined with an aggressive Israeli incursion into these areas? How has it affected life there?
Well, towns like Jenin, Nablus, the big cities in the West Bank, have been effectively isolated from each other now for a couple of years, but Israeli forces have blockaded them, raided them regularly, almost nightly in the case of Jenin, during part of this summer, in a continuing search for what Israel calls wanted men, arrested large numbers of young men, detained them. There was a very famous much talked about Israeli incursion into the Jenin refugee camp more than 2 years ago, in which a large portion of the camp, the center of the camp, was smashed by Israeli bulldozers. People in Jenin describe a beginning state of social chaos, a kind of steady social erosion. The Palestinian Authority continues to function, but really only in providing paychecks and running the schools. Those are both very important functions, but they aren't leadership functions. They aren't the kind of things that provide coherence to a society. Law enforcement is broken down in Jenin. The police no longer have any respect. They've been forbidden by Israel to carry weapons for a couple of years now because Israel said many of them were using those weapons against Israeli soldiers. There are policemen by day, terrorists by night, that sort of thing. And it's surprising, given that absence of law, to what extent order has managed to be sustained there, but it's breaking down. And the groups that are stepping into the vacuum and trying to provide some sort of order are actually the militant groups, particularly the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, which is a group linked to Arafat's Fatah faction. The leader of the Al-Aqsa Brigades in Jenin, a guy named Zakaria Zubaydah, told me he is now the highest authority there. Many people in Jenin say the same thing.
Now, what's interesting is that the Fatah movement, you know, which is Arafat has been associated with, has traditionally believed in a two-state settlement to the Palestinian-Israeli problem. Whereas, you know, more militant groups like Hamas have taken a different view. Have the politics of the public of the citizens there changed? I mean, do you find more militant groups like Hamas becoming more popular than the Fatah movement?
This is true throughout the territories, but it's a nuanced condition. You have to study these numbers a little closely and talk to a lot of people. Those groups have gotten more popular. Groups like Hamas and even Islamic Jihad, but particularly Hamas, has become more popular in Jenin and elsewhere. But at least judging by the polling of Khalil Shikaki is the most eminent Palestinian political scientist. Palestinians themselves are actually in a more compromising mood than that support for Hamas would reflect. That is, they're still more lean towards a two-state solution rather than Hamas's goal, which is the total destruction of the state of Israel. I think a lot of the support for Hamas reflects not support for that overarching goal, but rather opposition to the Palestinian Authority, unhappiness with Fatah, which dominates the Palestinian Authority, because they see a government that's failed to meet their needs, that has produced a lot of corrupt office holders who've enriched themselves without doing much for their people. That frustration is leading Palestinians to look for some other alternative form of leadership. That's what takes them towards Hamas. The anger in Jenin at the Palestinian Authority, and even anger at Yasser Arafat himself now, is quite striking.
Is that because they failed to provide security, or because they've failed to provide jobs and development?
Both. Both. It's the absence of a normal, tranquil, secure life in the Palestinian territories that's driving a lot of this. I mean, people want to do the same things there that people want to do all over the world. They want to be able to get up and go to work in the morning. They want to know that their children are safe. They want to be able to send their kids to decent schools. They want to see the garbage picked up in their streets. I mean, this is very basic governance, and I think a lot of people lose track of that when they see this thing only in terms of a conflict, only in terms of suicide bombers and Israeli soldiers. And they don't think about it as two societies made up of people who just want to live normal lives and cannot seem to find a way to make that happen.
As people in places like Jenin see the security barrier going up, what do they think that means for their own future?
Jenin historically survived economically because its residents were able to work in Israel. They went to jobs in Israel. They sold vegetables in Israel. They worked construction there. That is disappearing now, and people in Jenin don't really have an alternative yet. They don't know how they're going to survive economically once this break occurs. So you can barely see the fence from Jenin. At that point, it is fence rather than wall, a chain link fence that's going up with a number of roads and electronic monitoring and Israeli pillboxes spread out along it. But they used to be able to, even in the first couple of years of the conflict, get back and forth out of Jenin fairly easily, and those days have now come to an end. And I think a lot of people there don't really, they're having a lot of trouble, I think, now looking ahead and saying, what's life going to be like here a year from now, 2 years from now? I don't think, it's a question I kept asking, and I never got very good answers from people.
Has the erection of the security barrier in Jenin had an impact on suicide bombings in Israel?
Unmistakably, yes. And the number of attacks from Jenin has dwindled as the barrier has been built, and it's now dropped to zero, according to Israeli security. That is, attacks launched from Jenin across the boundary with the West Bank into Israel. Those have almost entirely stopped. I think it's partly a function of the barrier. It's partly a function of the disarray in these groups now. And I got the impression from Zakaria Zubaida that he spends more time these days thinking about law and order in Jenin and his role as kind of warlord in this small enclave, as opposed to thinking about how to go after the Israelis.
What about the population? I mean, you know, you write and many others write about the fervor of Palestinian mothers and fathers to send their sons to fight the Israelis. Is there less commitment to that now?
You can still find that, and sometimes it's because people believe it, and sometimes it's because people know that that's what they're expected to say, which is a tremendous problem. It's almost worse in a sense because it tells you what the social expectation is or how fearful they are of these militant groups. They don't want to criticize them. And I should say, by the way, that while some parents do praise their children for having, as they would say, martyred themselves in the cause, there are parents, a lot of parents, who are very unhappy about this. I was standing at a falafel stand in Jenin one evening, and it turned out that I fell into conversation with a guy next to me, and it turned out, like so many residents of Jenin, he'd lost his child. A son of his carried out a suicidal shooting attack on an Israeli settlement and was killed in the process. This guy was not proud of what his son had done. He mourned his son every day, he said, every second, he said. And there is a sense of exhaustion and despair in the Palestinian territories now that maybe would provide some political basis for a way out of this conflict.
If the security barrier were to become, in effect, a border for decades, and you know, this barrier in places is huge and electrified and fortified, is what's left of the West Bank the basis for a viable Palestinian state?
This is a question I'm just not qualified to answer. I can at least tell you some of the areas I would think would need to be addressed for that to happen. There's a fair amount of thinking that's being done in the World Bank about how you would create an economically viable Palestinian state if you were able to stitch together some sort of sovereignty in the West Bank with sovereignty in Gaza. But all that thinking in the past has been premised on the idea that there would be free flow of goods between Israel and the Palestinian territories. That is, that the Palestinians would be able to work in Israel, that they'd be able to sell goods to Israel. That's always been the relationship. That's disappearing now because of this barrier. People talk about the barrier in terms of its security effects and its potential political effects, but some of its most profound consequences are actually economic. And how you would create a state that could function alongside Israel and be viable is a very big question. It's possible that by opening the border with Jordan, allowing flow of goods back and forth there, if Palestinian wages came down. Palestinian wages have been artificially, one might say, inflated by the proximity to the Israelis, who pay more for labor than the Egyptians or the Jordanians. Maybe if the Palestinian wages came down, they'd become more economically competitive. But at the moment, with this tight division and with Israel still saying that they're going to need to control access for the Palestinians to Jordan and Egypt, because Israel says there's no way other way that they can prevent arms from flowing across those borders, as long as those controls remain in place, I think it's going to be very hard for the Palestinians to maintain a self-sufficient economy. Already, the Palestinian economy is extraordinarily dependent on donations from abroad, to an extent unequaled, according to the World Bank, by any country since World War II.
The security barrier appears to restrict suicide bombings and play a real security role. At the same time, it clearly inhibits the economic interactions that are important for both Palestinians and Israelis. How are people evaluating, in balance, kind of the wisdom of this?
Israelis overwhelmingly believe it's necessary, essential for their own security. Even some Palestinians will say the idea of a barrier and separation of these two peoples is not necessarily a bad idea, that there needs to be something that can force the two sides to cool off a little bit. The great Palestinian complaint is not that the barrier exists, but that it's being built partly in the West Bank. Now, I think from the Palestinian leadership, this is probably a little bit disingenuous, and they are opposed to the barrier in itself, partly for the economic reasons that we discussed earlier. But the Palestinian complaint is essentially that it's not just about securing Israelis, that it isn't a security barrier at all, that it's a political barrier that's consuming West Bank land deliberately in order to make part of the West Bank part of Israel forever. So when the International Court of Justice in The Hague ruled against Israel on this barrier over the course of the summer, the ruling didn't speak to the barrier itself. It spoke to the route that the barrier was taking. It's a nuanced point that kind of gets lost in the debate back and forth, but the real complaint that's made on the Palestinian side is where it's being built rather than whether it's being built. I don't think they'd be unhappy. I don't think they'd be overwhelmingly happy with it if it were right on this boundary, but they're certainly very unhappy with it where it's being built.
The view of many Israelis that Palestinians were never serious about a two-state solution, that they only wanted to advance the agenda of the complete destruction of Israel. To what extent do you think that's an accurate view of I mean, I know Palestinians have diverse views, but to what extent is that a widely or dominantly held view among Palestinians and their leadership?
I had one of Sharon's top advisors estimated to me recently that maybe 30% of the society really felt that way, and he argued that the problem was that 30% was essentially in control of the conduct of the conflict. And I think actually there's a lot of sense in that. I don't think most Palestinians, as I said earlier, would welcome some sort of peace agreement that allowed them to live normal lives and gave them a sovereign state, but also gave them a functioning economy and the ability to educate their kids in peace. But there's no question there are powerful elements in Palestinian society now that have the destruction of Israel as their goal. And essentially, they've been empowered by the way this conflict has been conducted. It should be said that while Israelis may believe that the Palestinians were never serious about the two-state solution. Palestinians generally now believe the same thing of Israelis, that is, that Israelis were never serious about it. It's been a process of kind of symmetrical disillusionment, as is so often true in this conflict. Something that's found on one side of it has its analog, really its mirror image on the other side. Palestinians say, look, the population of settlements doubled over the course of the Oslo peace process, which is true. They say, how could we possibly believe Israel was ever serious about this process, that they were ever serious about giving up the West Bank and allowing us to build a state here while they were bringing more settlers into this territory?
You've written about a man named Elias Khoury in The Times. Tell us why he's such a compelling figure to you. Not a political leader.
Elias Khoury is an amazing man who has suffered greatly, not just in this intifada, but from the grinding conflict between Jews and Arabs. His father and his family owned a great deal of land in northern Israel and was dispossessed in the Arab-Israeli War in 1948. His father believed he could work through the system legally to get the land back. He took Israeli citizenship. Elias is now an Israeli Arab himself, and Elias himself went to law school, became a lawyer. His father was killed in the mid-70s walking through Zion Square in Jerusalem. He was blown up by a bomb that Palestinians had hidden in a refrigerator there, killed several Israeli citizens, including Elias Khoury's father. Earlier this year, Elias's son, George, went for a jog in the French Hill neighborhood of Jerusalem, which is a neighborhood built on occupied West Bank land, and was shot dead by members of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, who then issued a statement saying that they'd successfully killed an Israeli settler. So Elias Khoury has lost his father and his son to Palestinian violence and finds himself in this extremely sorrowful position.
The Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade ultimately realized that, in fact, they had shot a Palestinian, didn't they?
Yeah, they realized it pretty quickly. I mean, it became a news story. The boy was identified, and I say boy, young man was identified. And they then issued a subsequent statement declaring that George Khoury was a martyr. His father rejected that. He said it hurt him a great deal to hear that. He is the kind of man that can't celebrate the deaths of anybody on either side of this conflict. He said to me, is this how we're going to build our state, you know, by killing people this way?
I think our time is short, but I want to ask you a few reflections about your time in the 3 years that you've spent in Israel and covering this conflict. You wrote that In one piece, that there was a time when the peace process had momentum, that Jews would go to an Arab nightclub in Ramallah. How much of the social interaction in Israel or in the West Bank between Jewish and Arab citizens has there been, and how have you seen that change in the time you've been there?
There's very little. There are still some people-to-people programs that continue to function, but as the checkpoints have hardened, it's gotten harder for people to get back and forth. I watched these checkpoints progress from fairly informal affairs to really bunkered, fenced points of the passage that look like international border crossings between hostile states. Obviously, the barrier was built during my time there, which I think is the biggest change in the landscape since the 1967 war. I would regularly ask Israelis who had had contact with Palestinians before the conflict, and I would ask Palestinians who had contact with Israelis before the conflict if they'd been able to maintain those communications. And often they say no, that it just came too hard to get messages back and forth, that they kind of lost track over the course of the fighting, and they came to have their opinions of the other side were degraded by the violence like everything else. And it's part of the great sadness of this conflict. And of course, the less contact there is like that, the more the difficult, the ugly contact comes to define the relationship. That is, Palestinian children who once were able to go to beaches in Israel now experience Israel and Israelis as the Israeli army, which is what they see in their towns. And on the Israeli side, Israelis largely think of Palestinians now, I think it's fair to say, as being defined by these suicide bombers that, for reasons they simply cannot understand, are willing to blow themselves apart in rooms that contain children, in buses on which children are riding.
This is, could be a dangerous part of the world. You were there with your family. Is it a relief to be away? Was it hard on you and your family to be there?
Oh, it was hard at times to be there. There's no question, particularly in periods when there are a large number of bombs going off. And I think it was sometimes hard on my wife when I was out trying to cover these military incursions in the territories. The kind of anxiety I spoke about earlier is anxiety that I definitely felt myself. Your wife calls you and tells you she's headed out to a store, to a grocery store, and once you've covered a couple of dozen suicide bombings, it's kind of hard not to ponder the variables. And that's hard. But in many ways, it is a wonderful place to live. You can't beat the climate. The people are very interesting. The expensive food is generally pretty bad, but the cheap food on the street is some of the best I've ever had. And there's a lot we're going to miss about our life there.
You were in a very dangerous situation yourself in May at Rafah, right?
Well, I was covering a very large Israeli incursion, a military invasion into Rafah at that time. Rafah's in the southern Gaza Strip. And it was about 9:30 at night, and I had been interviewing the wounded at a hospital, talking to some of the doctors. And I was on the phone, and I stepped out into the sandy street and wandered down it a ways. And a couple guys, a man approached me and offered his hand and a big handshake, saying, welcome. And I took his hand, and then he suddenly grabbed me, and another guy grabbed me from behind, and a car pulled up with the door open, and they were trying to shove me into the car. And it was a struggle, and I yelled for help. And the Palestinian police who were at the hospital came running. What actually worried me most in retrospect was that when the police came running, the guys did not immediately let me go. It turned into this kind of tug of war with me in the middle and the police pulling on one side and the guys pulling on the other and everybody yelling at each other. And finally, these men surrendered me and they disappeared. It's impossible for me to know how I was very scared after the fact. While it was happening, I was more bewildered than anything else because I just couldn't believe it was actually happening. It's hard to know how serious it was. These guys did not use guns. If they'd used guns, the outcome would have been far different, probably. They were using physical force. And the experience, of course, became then immediately a political football in the conflict, exaggerated by one side, minimized by the other, with some Palestinians claiming it never even really happened. In the end, in that sense, it just contributed to my own sort of personal sense of sadness about this impasse there, because what happened happened, and it was immediately interpreted through the reality of what happened, what I know happened, what I witnessed and experienced myself. That reality, in a sense, didn't seem to matter too much. It was how it could be used politically by one side or another that really mattered. And that's something you constantly deal with as a journalist there, this notion that we cling to, that there is an objective truth, that there are objective facts on the ground that can be ascertained. That's not so important to either side now. What's more important is not the actual reality, but that their version of reality prevail.
As you leave the Middle East after 3 years there, you've covered this conflict intensely, and people can get caught up in kind of the relentless tragedy of it and the way nothing seems to ever get any better. How much hope or despair do you leave the region with?
I think it's going to take us some time to kind of sort out our own experience there and what, if anything, it adds up to. I do feel, as I said to some colleagues when I was leaving, that we were leaving the place in worse shape than we found it. And I regret that. Do I think it's possible that they could come to some sort of agreement eventually? Yes, I do. I don't think this has to be endless warfare, but it certainly doesn't look to me like they're anywhere near it now. It doesn't look like anything like that is imminent. And I come away from the experience still feeling a great deal of compassion for both sides, believing strongly that it is possible to have compassion for both sides. And I leave sorry and frustrated because of this aspect that we talked about earlier, this inability of the two sides to come to terms on what the truth is, and their insistence, their bedrock insistence that their view is the only right one.
Well, James Bennett, thanks so much for speaking with us again.
Thank you.
James Bennett. He's just completed 3 years covering the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times.